We're here for argument in the case of ALL and DZ versus the people, and petitioner may proceed.
Your Honor, if it may please the court, I'm Barry Meinster. I represent the respondent mother, ALL. At council table with me is Deborah Gans. She represents the respondent father in the case, DZ. Allison Casillas is from the county attorney's office, and she will be speaking for the state of Colorado. Paula Young, who seceded to handle this case on behalf of the GAL, Donna Worley, was going to be here. She plans to be here. Sixth Avenue, I can tell you from personal experience, I was sweating it myself.
Yes.
But she did plan to be here, so Paula Young should be here. I was actually hoping that some members of the Evergreen High School mock trial team would be here today. I believe that they probably had the same problems that I did getting down here from the mountains. So hopefully if they come in, they'll get to see their coach.
Yes, I understand that. We were expecting them to come today, and,
yes,
and that's unfortunate, but perhaps they'll come down another time.
Yeah, well, it is, and I think that it would give them a chance to criticize their coach for what I do with them most of the year and the times that I've been coaching them. So in any event, Your Honor, this case is unusual in the sense that in a normal situation, I would be here trying to present why my argument is better than my opposition's argument, but I really don't have any opposition in this case, either from opposing counsel or from the amicus that filed briefs in this case. The other thing that makes it a little bit unusual is that I feel like I'm personally on trial here, so to speak, because it's myself who elected to file what one would consider, you know, what we've generically called an Anders type of brief. And I think that that background, although normally I wouldn't get into something like that, is important. But in this particular case, I think the position that attorneys are in when they're court appointed to handle appeals for respondent parents, I think is very relevant to what's going on here. And I took this case over from my wife, who was originally appointed as the my wife and partner, who was originally appointed as attorney for the respondent mother in this matter, and then she was appointed a district court magistrate in Jefferson County, and I probably would have done the appeal anyway, but I have handled a large number of appeals on behalf of guardian ad litems before the Court of Appeals, and I had never handled a case for a respondent parent. I don't do the trial work in these matters. What happened here was basically, as I set out in my brief, is that my partner and I, my wife and I, discussed this at length, and after reviewing a lot of petitions on behalf of respondent parents over the years, I just didn't want to file an appeal or a petition in this case, or in any case for that matter, that I felt didn't have merit. And it really placed me in a box, and I'll refer to her as Ms. Meinster. And I discussed this at length, and I, from handling a lot of the appeals on the GAL side, I knew a lot of the issues, and of course she, as a very well-known child advocate, she knew a lot from the other side of these cases. So we went over this thing and over this thing, and we couldn't come up with any issues that we would consider viable issues for appeal. And she went and she spoke with the respondent mother, ALL, and she explained this to her. And she talked to her on the phone, a number of times. And she tried to dissuade her from filing an appeal. But she wanted to file the appeal. And this placed us and ultimately me in a position where I was really in a box as far as the Code of Professional Responsibility goes, and all my obligations to my client and all the stuff that it says in there to do what they want me to do, to be a zealous advocate with my other responsibilities to the court, which were not to file frivolous pleadings, not to misrepresent things to the court, and not to, for lack of another word, waste the court's time. And
counsel,
yes, sir.
Since you don't have any opposition, maybe I'll try to give you a little bit, just something for you to talk to me about.
Go ahead, sir.
So, I don't mean to be flippant about this, and I apologize if it looks that way, but let me just play devil's advocate with this a little bit and say, you see yourself in such a bind here, and there's a number of things that you don't want to do, one of which is waste court time. Of course, an Anders brief doesn't save any court time. A court has to deal with that and deal with the lack of issues or the lack of merit to issues, and has to work through it in much the same way. So query whether there really is an issue about saving court time. However, with regard to your bind about your duties to your client, I guess I'm just curious why. Your primary obligation is to zealously represent. And if your zealous representation is to say, these are the issues that we have identified, which we wish could be resolved in our favor. Here's the law relevant to it. And although we prefer this result, we candidly admit the conclusions that are more readily drawn are thus and such, which I admit may to some degree resemble an Anders brief. But if that's as the best you get, isn't that zealous representation? And if it is, where's the bind?
I'm not sure I understand the court's question.
If the best argument you can make is the law's not really on our side, then why isn't that zealous representation?
Well, that, in essence, in my understanding, and if I understand the court's question, that is what an Anders brief is about, is coming up with potential issues that are in the case and briefing those issues and explaining at this level to the Court of Appeals.
Well, it also is about moving a brief in support of a motion to withdraw and then withdrawing as counsel. Isn't that also implicated in the in the case?
That is, Your Honor. The case in Utah, kind of what they're saying there is that, well, if the court's going to dismiss the appeal anyway, then what point does it, how important is the motion to withdraw? I think the motion to withdraw coupled with the Anders brief is in my mind designed to, if the Court of Appeals would disagree with my position in the case and say, well, we do think there is an issue here and we do think there's something here to argue, and since I've already said that I don't believe there is, then perhaps at that point the Court of Appeals would grant my motion to withdraw and appoint substitute counsel. Does that answer the court's question?
Well, not exactly. It sort of gets us started, though. So if you forget about the motion to withdraw part,
right,
and you're considering the Anders brief just to be a brief,
right,
that addresses issues but is not able to conclude that the law is in our favor, then why is that? I guess I'm not seeing why that's that significant. I mean, an attorney has an obligation in that respect with regard to issues that aren't in their favor, and frequently briefs do address some issues and raise law concerning things and candidly admit things that are not in counsel's favor. And usually they are a subpart of an issue that can somehow be skirted and go on to better things. But how is that really any different from what you would ordinarily do, except that your bottom line, your conclusion, is not asking the court to find something contrary to law?
Here's where I think the division between court-appointed counsel and private counsel comes in. Were I in that situation as privately retained counsel, after doing the exact same thing that I would do for in a court-appointed case, I wouldn't take the case.
And let's look at it, though. I mean, why is that different from the point of view of the client? I mean, so you have a client who can't find anyone to take the case. They still want to appeal. They still have that right. So what does that leave them, pro se?
Probably yes. I think the short answer is yes. I think if you have a private client that, I mean, unfortunately, as the court well knows, I guess if you've got enough money, you can always find some attorney out there to take any case. But putting that class aside there, I think that if you go to a number of attorneys and a number of attorneys evaluate the situation and say, there's just not a case here, you know, I'm just not going to take it. And at that point, a party that doesn't need court-appointed counsel could proceed pro se, which is the same thing that would happen here. You have, and the cornerstone of this really is that the attorney needs to be required to really take a real good look at the record, a real good look at the transcript. I was in somewhat of a different case because I wasn't trial counsel, but in this case has to work together with trial counsel and then come up and say, okay, here's everything I've done. I've tried to come up with it. I've given you my vigorous, zealous representation. I just can't come up with an issue. But then we get into, I'm thinking it's South Dakota case. I can't remember the exact site. But the case that broke it into two factors where it says, okay, counsel should file a two-part brief. You know, one part counsel sets out the issues that counsel sees as potential issues and why they aren't issues. And more than just, which was the Anders concern, more than just the letter, I don't see any issues, period, end of story, where they really analyze it and really come up with the law. And then they give the well, at that point, I guess it would be pro se, but at that point, the respondent parent an opportunity in Part B of that brief to present their issues to the court and say, okay, I think these other issues here exist. So you actually get the best of both worlds by incorporating that two-part process that, and again, I believe it was South Dakota that had this. So I think if you would get that in there.
It's a little unsettling, though, isn't it? You got your client pitted against the attorney there, and the court's reading a brief where the attorney who's schooled in the law and his experience is basically disagreeing with the client's position. That's kind of strange, isn't it?
I don't know that the attorney's necessarily disagreeing with the client's position, but the attorney is presenting a position that obviously is adverse to what the client's wishes are in the case. The client wants the appeal, but the attorney does not see any issues for the appeal. And I think that it does, I think it assists the, I'm sorry, were you going
to? Oh, go ahead.
No. I want to follow up on just one thing that was said, which is relevant here about the timing on this. I think it does save time for the Court of Appeals because I think that the Court of Appeals is in a situation where when the Court of Appeals gets one of these briefs, and I really don't want to use the word frivolous, and I'm doing that intentionally. These are good attorneys who are trying to do this. You know, none of the respondent parents' attorneys are, if you're familiar with the state pay scale, are getting rich off of this. They're good attorneys. They're putting their hearts into this thing. So let me use the word sparse, perhaps a brief that isn't quite as detailed as maybe it could be. The Court of Appeals has to take the time to go through the record anyway, to try to determine if, you know, what are these issues here. So the Court of Appeals is actually functioning, I don't want to use the word advocate, but the Court of Appeals is actually analyzing the thing, and it's taking them longer to do this than if appellate counsel for the respondent parents were assisting them by saying, here are some legitimate issues that could exist in this case. Here's the record. Here's why, you know, I don't think these issues exist. Does that answer the court's question?
One of the issues I'm interested in here is what do you want us to do with this particular case? Because we have a real real child here, young girl whose parental rights have, with respect to the mother, at least have not been terminated, right? What do you want us to do with the disposition of this particular case?
This is the dilemma that's created by this. What do I want to do? What do I want you to do as a human being?
I'm talking about you as an advocate. What should we do with this particular case? Is this particular case now ready to be decided? Have we gone through what you're advocating the Anders type process would be?
If this court adopts the Anders type brief, then I imagine at that point the order of the trial court will be sustained, which means that this child can be adopted at that point. So certainly that is in the best interest of the child that the court move as quickly as possible on this. And generalizing from that and answering your question, if trial counsel is assisting, and it's the wrong word, but if trial counsel is assisting the Court of Appeals by pointing out issues and helping the Court of Appeals come to a quicker decisions on these things, it will facilitate adoptions of these children because it will finalize these cases quicker. So that, I guess in short, is my answer to your question on the thing, is that the quicker we can get this resolved, I'm imagining if the court does not adopt my suggestion for an Anders brief, then at that point, there's an issue of whether I'm be allowed to withdraw or not. Somebody has to handle it, but at that point, then the process would begin anew as far as the appeal goes, because at that point, the court would order that a substantive brief be filed on the issues, which would start that whole process again before the Court of Appeals.
But at this stage of the game, we don't have an Anders brief. Is that right?
No, I did file an Anders brief.
Okay.
I did file an
Anders brief. So you, from your point of view, if we want to adopt this procedure, the case is ready to be decided.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
Could I ask a question there? Would we ever be able to allow counsel to withdraw without giving the parent an opportunity to proceed pro se?
I would think that the parent would always have the right to proceed pro se. I don't know that that's the best procedure, because I think that to strip a respondent parent of their right to appellate counsel at that point, the timing under 3.4 is so quick.
I'm a little confused. It seems to me we've got here the question immediately before us is, should counsel be permitted to withdraw because he doesn't see any issues? If he can, and then based on apparently what we think about that and whether there are issues, we need to decide whether to let him to withdraw, whether to appoint other counsel, or at the very least it would seem to allow the party an issue to proceed pro se. Is that wrong in terms of the sequence or the options for it?
Yes, I think that the Anders brief is hand in hand with the motion to withdraw. And I think that the motion withdrawal is probably, as I said before, probably secondary. I think that...
Well, let me just stop you there.
Go ahead.
I'm a little intrigued by the notion that that is secondary. Isn't that what's before us? Is a question, the first and foremost, whether counsel before us should be allowed to withdraw. And then if we allow that, what we should do next to protect the rights of this party?
That wasn't my understanding. My understanding was what was before this court is whether the court should allow appellate counsel, court-appointed appellate counsel for respondent parents to be able to file an Anders-type brief. And the motion to withdraw is, in my mind at least, although they're linked together, it's a secondary issue because respondent parents are entitled to appellate counsel. So if you just allow the attorney to withdraw without substitute counsel, and I think that denies the respondent parent of their right to appellate counsel.
If you file if counsel files an Anders brief,
right,
they're telling us, aren't they, that they cannot assist this party. They can't provide counsel anymore. They're not going to do anything. I mean, I'm not saying they're acting badly, but right, but what that counsel is saying is they've made the determination there's nothing to be done on behalf of this party. Now, so it seems to me we either, whether we agree with that or not, we may be in a position where we have to allow withdrawal. The question would seem to be, do we then, depending on whether we agree that there's nothing to be done, do we appoint other counsel or not appoint other counsel? That is, has the right to counsel been satisfied simply by having one counsel that adequately convinces us that there's nothing to be done? And even in that case, I guess what I'm asking is, should the party himself or herself have a right to appear and make whatever argument they could?
I think, to handle this in reverse order, I think the party should always have the right to have access to the court. So I think the party themselves, father or mother, should always have the right to pursue the appeal. All right. In my brief, and actually in my Anders brief that I originally filed, there is one issue that appellate counsel, if appellate counsel is trial counsel, can never handle, and that's ineffective assistance of counsel, okay? And I don't know if anyone would want to ask me a question about that, but the issue is that you have an attorney, and the attorney says, I represented this party, I've reviewed the record, I've done A, B, C, and D. There aren't any issues. I can't file any issues. I would like you to allow me to withdraw from the case, coupled with that Anders brief. And again, I underscore consistently, the Anders brief has got to be, as the Supreme Court said in Anders, it has to be more than just a letter to the court saying, hey, I looked at this thing and I don't see any issues here. It has to be an in-depth study. Okay, we have to start with that proposition. So assuming the attorney does that, then what's before the Court of Appeals is those issues. Now the Court of Appeals obviously can always disagree and say, well, wait, we've looked at the record here and there are additional, you know, we think that this is an issue. Or if the pro se party says, well, I think my trial counsel was ineffective, you know, I think they messed up during the trial, then that's another issue there that could be raised at that point. And perhaps you would need at that point to retain new counsel. But I'm trying to keep, again, the whole purpose of...
Let me ask you the question this way.
Yes, sir.
It seems to me if you have the motion to withdraw in the Anders brief,
yes, sir,
either the court is simply saying you can't assist, appoint someone else, and of course, one would like to think that the brief is well done and the issues aren't there. So the other possibility is the court is saying the right to counsel is no longer active here. They aren't entitled to substitute counsel because there aren't any issues. which probably means the court has to be convinced there aren't any issues, but you have really a right to counsel at stake. Or, and I thought where Anders went, was the court is saying, there aren't any issues, so there's no right to appeal. And so it's the right to appeal that's at stake, unless I'm misunderstanding Anders. And so I guess the question, it seems to me, is, what's at stake? Just this particular lawyer and you can get another one? Or is the right to counsel or the right to appeal at stake in the determination that there are no issues to be addressed?
All those things are at stake, but you resolve them. You're not denying the respondent parent, the indigent party, right to counsel. You know, they have the right to counsel. You're not denying them the right to appeal. The Anders decision would not be, well, you know, we understand what the attorney said, we accept this, there's no right to appeal. What I believe happened in Anders and the other state cases was that they dismissed the appeal, which is something that the appellate court could do anyway. The appellate court would look at it and dismiss it. There aren't any issues here. So you still preserve the right to, and I don't think that's sophistry, but the appellate court, you still preserve the right to appeal and gave them their chance. You just at the appropriate time dismissed it. It would be the same thing with right to counsel.
Let me ask you a slightly different question, and that is, everyone agrees there's a need for this. What is it, has anyone looked into, and I guess you have to answer it for your part, whether this is actually used in criminal cases? I mean, I for one haven't seen one. Of course, I don't sit on the Court of Appeals. Maybe that would be the more likely place. So I'm curious, if there's a great need, has it been used in criminal cases? And also, what is the procedure in Colorado in criminal cases?
You know, I honestly can't. I don't do criminal appeals. In fact, there's very little criminal work I do beyond the misdemeanor here and there. I'm really not involved in that.
But it would seem that that's an appropriate source of information for us with regard to what procedure we might consider adopting and whether, in fact, there is a need for this in the...
I think there's a... In my discussions with many other attorneys who handle these cases in the child welfare area, is that, yes, there is a need for it. Attorneys have to have an option to filing a frivolous brief. They have to have that.
That's because of the fear of sanction by us as the licensing authority. Isn't that the only motivation?
No.
What other motivation would there be?
I'm not saying that's not a fear, but as I said before, these are good people. These are good attorneys. They're honest attorneys. They want to further the interests of justice, truly. And from a moral standpoint, I mean, I think a good, not just ethical in the, you know, what does the code say, but ethical in the moral sense, don't want to waste the court's time. Don't want to bring things up before the court that can't be sustained. So I think it's beyond just a fear that they're going to be sanctioned. I think that it's a genuine concern for the administration of justice, and how do we make this whole process move as smoothly as possible? So I think that it's more than just, hey, you know, like, I mean, why don't we all go 80 miles an hour on the highway? You know, is it just because we don't want to get tickets, or is there something else involved here? It's the same thing. It's beyond just the fact that they could be sanctioned. It truly is something from the heart that they want these kids to be freed for adoption as soon as possible. They want justice for both sides of this case, and the respondent parents' attorneys, the GALs, the county attorneys, they want justice in these cases. They want it as quickly as possible, which again, I believe is the purpose behind 3.4 and the short timings. So I think that's what's motivating them, and that these appeals that counsel are going to be forced, well, they have been forced actually up until this case, forced to file these appeals that they have to come up with issues, are taking everyone's time. They're taking time, they're costing the Court of Appeals time, because the Court of Appeals doesn't have the input of somebody who's looked at this thing. The Court of Appeals has to go, you know, practically a de novo review on these things, and it's dragging it out, and it's dragging out the timing, and it's dragging out the time that these children can get permanent homes, and they can get secure in their placements for the rest of their lives. So I think that's what's motivating it. I'm not minimizing the professional sanctions this court could impose, but I really believe that's what, from my conversations and my involvement in this area of the law, is that that's what the people are, the attorneys are interested in. Does that answer the court's question?
Well, I'm not sure, because I think the real issue is whether you have an attorney who's competent, who's done his or her best. The court takes it over from there. It's hard for me to see why this withdrawal of counsel does anything. I suppose you could have the client make a statement, but if the attorney has worked through the facts and the law and can't even come up with an insufficient evidence, the state didn't prove meet its burden of taking the child away, and therefore the parental rights survives. I mean, that seems to me in these kind of cases, that can always be said and argued, competently. But it seems to me that this complete circle of, you know, the client now gets to be pro se, you can't withdraw, or you can withdraw. Why isn't the brief just accepted for the best that can be done in the case and the decision made by the Court of Appeals?
What you are saying is what's being done, and I believe that that is not the way it should be done. That's why I'm arguing this case. I don't think that if you look at a case and you realize that the appellate review is clear and convincing, and you know that there's evidence in that record that justified the trial court's decision, and you put in there, I don't think the trial court had sufficient evidence. That, in my mind, is still not being candid with the court. In my mind, that's still stretching it. Yes, you can do that in any case. But is that really what the interests of justice are about in these particular...
Well, it seems to me the way you describe it, though, is that the attorney sitting there as a judge and deciding it's in the best interest of the child, who you're not representing.
Right.
Who you're not representing.
That's right.
You're representing the parents' rights,
right,
which exist until proven otherwise.
Right, that is.
So you don't have to draw the bottom line that there's not clear and convincing evidence in the case, do you? I mean, that's up to the court to do, isn't it? The trial court and the Court of Appeals?
Ultimately, yes. But if you look at it and you know that you have no argument that there wasn't evidence for the trial court to base its decision on. You know that. You see, you know, these psychiatrists or psychologists and doctors or whoever it is and the social workers and what have you had all this testimony that justified the court's decision. Yes, yeah, you could still make that argument, but aren't you still, in my mind at least, wasting the court's time on that?
But doesn't that take you right back to where we started, which is, isn't that basically an Anders brief without the withdrawal? In other words, my best issue is insufficiency of evidence. Here's the evidence. List of overwhelming evidence follows. My client, here's the law. Law not very supportive follows. My client would like to succeed with the appeal. Goodbye. That's almost indistinguishable, except in terms of, you know, maybe some additional conclusions that really aren't necessary for the court, from the Anders brief to begin with. So I think what Justice Hobbs is asking is where we started, which is, why not you file your brief? You don't have to mislead the court. You are just candid about the law and raise and bring forth the issues that seem to be the only ones recognizable. And that's all there is to it.
But, Your Honor, that is the Anders brief. It's, well, you know, one of the issues in this case is potentially that the court didn't have sufficient evidence to base its decision by clear and convincing evidence. And then the Anders brief would go on to say, you know, that's a potential issue that I see in the case. But You had Dr. So-and-so, you had the social worker, you had the foster mother, you had this, you had that, you had the next thing that testified. The court, the trial court did have evidence that he could base its decision upon. So I think I'm agreeing with what you're saying is, yes, that is the basis of the Anders brief, is to point out, yeah, this is an issue, but in my Anders brief that I filed in this, I pointed out two ICWA issues, Indian Child Welfare Act. I pointed out two Indian Child Welfare Act potential issues, one or two of them, in any event. And then I said, you know, here's some issues that in an ICWA type of case would come up, but here's how the judge addressed them. And here's the burden of proof the judge used. And so I did in my Anders brief what I believe you're suggesting.
Well, in the adversary system, I'm sorry, you know, you're out of time, but I guess I'll ask this with the Chief Justice's permission. The other side would bring that up. There's another side in this case. The ICWA issues are satisfied. The tribe was given a chance to comment. They decided not to. Or they did, and the judge decided against them based on the evidence. I mean, why do you have to anticipate briefing both sides of it?
Well, that's what the Anders brief would require. If this court were to adopt Anders as I've read it, as the various states have adopted it, it adopted it to DNNs, because again, I really can't speak to
it. It just seems that it functions as admission against interest on behalf of your client. You know, that you have that additional burden as a counsel to brief the other side's position. And we have perfectly competent counsel on the other side in a lot of these cases. You'd agree with that, right?
Yeah, I find myself on the other side many times.
Yeah.
Hopefully
okay.
I fall into that category. So, yeah, yes. But I agree with you on that. The issue, again, is that if counsel looks at something, is it permissible to say, in my mind, I know that, and let's just deal with the burden of proof issue, I know that the burden of proof was met. Is that permissible from a moral or from an ethical, as far as the code goes? Is that permissible for me to say, okay, you know, I'm going to file this anyway, even though I know that there's no basis for this? Is that permissible? And that's the dilemma, and that I think that appellate counsel are facing these cases. Is there any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Allison Casillas, and I am the Special Assistant County Attorney for Lake County Human Services. I thank you for the opportunity to be here today. As Mr. Meinster mentioned, there is not an opposition, so to speak, about adopting Anders. But there are some other issues, I think, that from the county's perspective that we would like the court to address. If I can first go back to some of the issues that came up with Mr. Meinster. The question of does it have to be attached to the withdrawal of counsel, I don't think that it does. I think that the court can adopt Anders without having to tie it to a motion to withdraw. I think that a counsel should be able to file the motion or file an Anders brief in the same way they would file any other brief, with the exception that at the very end, after you've made your analysis, that would allow you to not take that final step of saying, the court was wrong, it needs to be overturned, which is where I think the ethical dilemma comes.
Could I just interject at this point then? I was just looking at this ethics opinion 114. You're aware of that?
I haven't looked at it.
Did you want to, I don't know whether you have it in front of you, you need to look at it, but it seems to make the point, and of course it's not law, but just an ethics opinion, that in a case such as the one that we're dealing with today where there is this very specific conflict, that it's the ethical obligation of the attorney to file an appeal and request permission to withdraw. And in terms of filing the appeal, to indicate to the court that the parents' claims lack merit. But it very definitely couples those two things together. What in light of that, why are you taking a different position on that?
I think as the law stands now, you would need to withdraw.
This Essex opinion was written in 2006, October 2006.
But I think if the court adopts Anders, that would relieve that conflict. I think the adoption of Anders is what relieves the necessity of asking to withdraw, because it has now given a counsel an avenue to make that argument and not, and still be under the law.
So much of this is semantic, you know, frankly, and but if, so you read the ethics opinion as simply allowing the attorney to say, I filed my notice of appeal and now I'm informing the court in something, a brief, that I don't think this appeal has any merit and I want to withdraw. That's different in your mind than the Anders proceeding that we're talking about today?
I think it depends. I think Anders is relatively open. I think that the follow-up rulings have been that it's within the court's discretion to set it how you think fit. And so I think it is possible for the court to adopt Anders and not couple it under all circumstances with a motion to withdraw. I think the court could say, in fact, in Utah, I think they have said you have an obligation to go on. You are not to be relieved. And so I think it's within the court's discretion to say, you are given the opportunity to file this brief to say, I've reviewed all of the issues. I don't find anything that would warrant overturning the previous courts. Whereas I think you're prohibited from doing that right now. I really feel like your obligation as appellate counsel is to make the ultimate claim that your client wants you to make. And that tends to fall into the general, there's insufficient evidence,
that's actually not what this ethical decision seems to suggest. I mean, it seems to suggest that you're not in that position where you have to make a frivolous claim, but rather you have to ask to withdraw after you've perfected the appeal and filed something with the court.
I guess I don't see the conflict in that.
Okay.
I think you can move to withdraw. And if the court can appoint substitute counsel, I think that's always possible.
Well, so that's my problem with some of the questions that we've been asking is, you know, if one attorney files a motion to withdraw, you grant it, then the next attorney's in exactly the same position, and that can just go on forever.
Yes.
And so we've got to get ourselves out of this circle somehow. And so my question is what's the best way to get out of this?
And I think the best way to get out of it is to allow the Anders brief, to not tie it to a motion to withdraw, because I think at that point you've triggered all of these questions of a right to appellate counsel. I think that the ultimate Anders brief is essentially your petition on appeal, but it allows counsel to make the ultimate conclusion at the end, where usually they would not have the ability under the ethical rules to say, I don't think I've met my burden. I don't think that the court should overturn. Which to me is the difference. I think that,
and the lawyer would not withdraw, so you'd be having an attorney still in the case, not withdrawing and taking the position that this appeal has no merit.
Yes.
But may I follow up one question?
Sure.
Whether we say withdraw or not, maybe you're right about how we use that language. But surely you'd agree, wouldn't you, that if an attorney files something in the nature of an Anders brief, the party has to be given an opportunity to raise separate issues on their own.
Yes, I would. And under that premise, I would ask the court to seriously consider adopting what they adopted in Korth, which is the South Dakota Court of Appeals, or the South Dakota case adopting Anders. And in South Dakota, they have adopted the procedure where counsel submits, they say, in Part A and Part B, or Section 1 and Section 2, Section 1, all of the issues in the same way they always would, saying, here are possible issues on appeal, here's my review of the record and the facts, and I don't find anything that would warrant being reversed. Part B of that same petition is the respondent parent's ability to make those claims on his or her own. Of course, the obvious one there being ineffective, which creates a whole other kind of set of issues there. But it does allow that parent to say, I think my counsel is wrong. I think that this was the problem. I think that there wasn't sufficient evidence, or whatever claim that they choose to make, but it does at least give them that avenue still to address the court.
And can I just do one follow-up? And then after that procedure, I mean, accepting that that has to be done, then if the court independently evaluates the situation and decides there really are issues that could be raised, then does the court have to appoint substitute counsel?
I have wavered on this. I think yes. I think at that point, once a counsel has gone on record and saying this isn't a good claim and the Court of Appeals finds otherwise, actually, I should back up on that. I think that the court has the option of ordering the supplemental briefing at that point, and I think that it could be.
Well, and that's the point I wanted to get at. So you're suggesting it might be an option after counsel has said, I see nothing to appeal to assist my client, for the court to say, yes, there is, go back and find it.
Go back and hunt harder, yes.
Leave the party represented by counsel who's just said, I don't believe there's anything to be done on my...
Well, and again, I think my perspective is, I think you do have to probably appoint substitute counsel at that point. But I will tell you that I think it's in reading some of these other cases, there have been other states that have said you must drive on. I'm a little bothered by that personally. But so I think that the court, and obviously that creates... It does create timing problems if you need to go back at that point and substitute, which, of course, is not the ultimate goal. But I think it will have to be done just for the sake of justice at that point.
Well, and it creates ineffective assistance of counsel problems, doesn't it? I mean, if the court's saying to the lawyer,
you're wrong,
you missed something.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess why? It seems to me inevitably you go into that and you're prolonging this whole process and procedure. And if I understood your argument, the dilemma at the beginning that causes you to think that we should go that direction is because the lawyer can't say none of these issues have merit. The lawyer can't say, I think you should rule against me, which is fine. I don't see why the lawyer has to say that. And so my question is, why can't the lawyer just file a brief that says, these are the best issues I could identify? My client has identified no others, thereby relieving the necessity of going back to the client for more issues. Here's the facts. Here's the law.
And not ask the court to do anything.
And not ask the court to, as counsel, not represent to the court that this law is in their favor, or the outcome is in their favor. I suppose the representation my client would like to succeed on appeal. Might be just fine, but why should the lawyer go the additional step of advocating the other side of the case?
I don't know that necessarily involves advocating the other side, but I think to end it and not ask the court or not suggest to the court that the ruling should be changed, that they should win the appeal, I think has now taken them out of the role of an advocate and has put them into the role.
Why does that take them out of the role of advocate? Is if the best job that the advocate can do is not, they don't have a meritorious issue, then haven't they done all that an advocate can do?
Yes.
Well, then why are they out of the role of advocate? If the best advocacy is, these are my client's issues, here's the facts, here's the law, that's the best anyone can do, why is that not proper advocacy?
Now, you might add to that, this is my client's point of view. Here's what my client says about this. Mike, why can't you also include that?
I think you can, but I think that's exactly what we're asking them to be able to do.
Well, I want to raise a slightly different point with you. It looks like we have a couple of models of how other states have handled this, and Utah did it by rule change, apparently, and South Dakota, I guess, did it by decision. Do you think that, are you recommending that we pursue a rule change, for example, where decision, just doing it by decision? Do you have any position on that?
I think the rules are tied. I think it ought to be done by decision, however. I think ultimately, though, it does address, and I'm hoping to have time as well to address this with the court, it does have certain effects on Rule 3.4 that I would like the court to consider. I think it can, I would ask that it be done by decision, but if it is done by decision, it can be, and I think should be done within the time frames of 3.4. I think that an Anders brief would be due at the same time as the petition under 3.4 would be due, and wouldn't change the time frames, because of course my ultimate goal is to place that child as...
Could I just ask you why you think a decision is better than a rule?
I think the authority of being able to model it off of different states and the different things that they have adopted. And I understand that obviously a committee could be appointed and would do it by rule as well, but I think it is more a question of principle and of overall, of more of an ethical guideline than saying we've adopted this procedure. I think that it's more appropriate to be done through a court ruling. And I think actually Utah has done it as well through court rulings. Their appellate procedure was done beforehand, their expedited procedure, and then they've had case law as well that puts it within the rule. So I don't think that they have made really rule changes in Utah specifically for their Anders adoption. I think what they have found is that it can be done within their expedited timeframes. And so the adjustments that they've made to their rules have been more a question, I think, of timing than of actual adoption. If I can briefly address the court about 3.4, I would ask the court to consider, in conjunction with the ruling, as I say, it should be done in a ruling and not in an appellate rule. I think, as I say that, there are changes, I think, that would have to be made to the rules, but relatively minor. And primarily, I would ask the court to consider, and this is not actually specific to Anders, but to all of appellate work in DNN cases, under 3.4, specifically E6, and that is a reference to transcripts. And several of the briefs mention transcripts. As the timing lays out right now, briefs are due in 20 days. Transcripts aren't due for 40 days. Mm. And so often there are briefs written, whether they be Anders or not, without the benefit of a transcript. E6 allows for unedited transcripts, although there's no time frame attached to that. And they're not available in a lot of counties. And so I think it puts position of counsel, let alone if it's be substitute counsel who didn't have the benefit of participating in the trial, of having to write a petition without having been at trial and without having a transcript of any kind, which I think is inefficient. The rule does allow for supplementing it later on. But if trial counsel or if appellate counsel has had to write a brief without the benefit of a transcript or having been at the trial, it's going to be a lot more than a supplemental brief. It's essentially going to be a second round of briefing, which seems ineffective financially, certainly for timing of the court, for the court to have to review a second set of briefs. I would ask the court to consider adopting an amendment or an additional rule under 3.4 E6 that allows for an unedited transcript within 5 days. That was originally discussed, I think, when it was adopted, but was not adopted in the final rule. And I think that would expedite the appeals, whether they be Anders or not. Certainly on an Anders brief, you would expect someone to review the record in the same way they would under any other petition. And so I would ask the court to consider that.
Isn't the logical follow-up there, though, that we ought to extend the time so that you have an adequate transcript that the court can be comfortable with, that attorneys can be comfortable with? Why are we rushing so hard in between 5 and 20 and 35 days here?
I think we are rushing because there is a 6-year-old who wants to be adopted. And the legislature and the courts have held repeatedly that this is important and that this should be a priority and that we have an obligation to expedite these cases as much as we can, certainly within the frames of due process. And so, although that's a possibility, you could extend it. To be honest, I think extending it's a better idea than having it briefed twice. That seems like a waste of resources. But I think the better option is to shorten the time frame for a transcript. Because although that's certainly extra resources to ask that transcript to be completed in 5 days, the alternative there is that you have asked respondent parent counsel, a county attorney, a guardian ad litem to brief twice, and you've asked the Court of Appeals to review too. To me, the extra resources of asking for a quicker transcript is well justified.
Well, I'm missing something here, because usually these children are placed in a foster home pending the adoption. The adoption can be the person that did the interim care or not.
It could be.
Or relative or somebody else,
And they can be.
So I'm just not understanding why the adoption process needs to be that quick, that a transcript that is satisfactory shouldn't be required.
I think a transcript that's satisfactory should be required. I'm just saying it should be required faster. Because I think of course, the ultimate goal is adoption. And so I think you can't equate being in foster care with being adopted.
And we've
said that, I think, in the law several times. But beyond that, some of those children, and in this case, I'm happy to say that's the case in this current case, is that child is in the placement where we expect her to remain. But that is not always the case. There are kids who are placed in foster care who are not eligible to be adopted. And we haven't begun that process, and it does absolutely affect a child's ability to find an adoptive home if there is pending litigation.
With respect to the dialogue we just had, the first half hour presentation, the county is trying to represent or attempting to represent both the interest of the state and saying that it's in the interest of the child.
Sure.
We have a person in there probably who's representing the child.
Yes.
We have the other attorney is doing the best he or she can to represent the parent. I mean, we want that. That's the adversary framework. We want these things to work with. So, why is it your position we don't need under the current ethical rules to put counsel in the position of advocating any of those other interests, the state or the best interest of the child, and simply do the best they can? It seems to me the Anders brief is an artifice, is what I'm saying here, especially coupled with a motion to withdraw that signals to the court that this is a frivolous appeal. It just smacks of, we're trying to accomplish things here within our ethical rules. We ought to just admit that in this social service context, the ethical rule of filing a frivolous brief doesn't apply, as long as you don't misrepresent.
I think that is possible. I think that there have been, and I'm going to have to look, I want to say Florida adopted that procedure. And their answer to that was that they changed the ethical rules. They said, go ahead and file your frivolous brief. We're okay with it. I don't think that's the best option, but I do think it is a possibility. I think other courts have done that.
In one of your responses to Justice Hobbs, I'm sure I know what you mean, but you said the ultimate goal here is adoption. But of course you meant assuming that termination is appropriate. And the goal in this proceeding is to decide whether termination of parental rights really is appropriate or not, is justified. And so what we're trying to do is decide whether the parent has been adequately represented or gets adequate representation to make that determination. And this is the problem I see with regard to substitute counsel. Timing is a big problem, but if we've decided there really are issues to be raised and substitute counsel has to be appointed to represent the person in order to make that determination, then it seems like we're going to have to find some accommodation, but it can't involve divesting that parent of their parental rights without representation. Could I just ask you, it's turned into too much of a speech, the question I wanted to get to, though, is could you just explain to me how you understand the parent's right to counsel, both constitutionally and statutorily? What is the right?
I think it's clear that they do not have a constitutional right to appellate counsel, but Colorado has granted a statutory right to counsel, and I do agree with you that once the state has provided that statutory right, they have an obligation to enforce it and make it real, so to speak. So I don't disagree with the idea that ultimately due process applies and has to be an overriding concern in everything that the court does. But I also think that the case law has shown over and over again that due process is not violated by working under the expedited timeframes, and that there's good cause for doing that. The legislature and the courts have found that good cause and that it can be done. It's more difficult, without a doubt. And I certainly don't mean to imply that expedited timeframes need to trump a parent's right to counsel or a parent's due process rights, but I think they can be done together, and I think both goals need to be focused.
And I heard you saying there, you think, though, even if this right is only statutory, that once granted by the legislature, it entails the same, it's to the same extent as a constitutional right? And
I think so, in the sense that when it affects your due process rights, once you've been granted that, I think it has to be looked at through the lens of providing.
Could I ask you one narrow question here? I wasn't sure about the way this statute is set up. Do you think it grants a right only with regard to parental termination?
Versus
a statutory right. I know early we talk in that statute dealing with dependency and neglect proceedings about being advised of your right to, you know, whatever all the rights are, and one of them to seek appointment of counsel if you can't afford it. Is there a provision that actually says you're entitled to counsel other than the provision in the termination statute that says if a motion to terminate is filed, you'll be appointed counsel if you can't afford one?
And if there's a final judgment that isn't termination?
Well, yeah. Is that when you're entitled to counsel with regard to a motion to terminate?
Now, I can't think of a circumstance where there would have been an appeal by a respondent parent where there wasn't termination involved.
Maybe I misunderstood the statute. I thought a parent could appeal from a ruling of dependency and neglect.
I think they could. I just can't think of a...
Do you think they have a right to counsel with regard to that kind of an appeal? Is that statutorily granted as well?
I have to confess, I don't know, but my reaction would be yes, that if that ultimately is going to affect, it's going to affect the final outcome, I think they probably are entitled.
Could I bring you back a little bit to this case? So if we decide that Anders is not appropriate, then where does it leave this case in the Court of Appeals?
I think it returns it to... I think ultimately it returns to the trial court. And again, back to the question of whether or not you would have to grant substitute counsel.
And it would return it to the trial court. So the procedural posture right now is that it was sitting in the Court of Appeals with a motion to withdraw pending.
Yes.
And everything now is here. So, and we took that case at the Court of Appeals request. So we then, to resolve this case, would have to do what? We would have to decide the Anders brief is appropriate and rule on the sufficiency of the Anders brief and rule on the motion to withdraw.
I think you would have to rule on whether to adopt Anders. If the court adopted Anders, whether or not the Anders brief was sufficient. And if the court finds that the Anders brief is sufficient, I don't think at that point there's any reason to rule on the motion to withdraw because I think the case is finished. If the court does not find the Anders brief sufficient, I think at that point, and again, I think this is the court's prerogative, but I think at that point you make the decision whether or not the conflict is so great that you have to appoint substitute counsel and return it. I guess you do grant the motion to withdraw, but the alternative, you will appoint substitute counsel, and substitute counsel at that point has to petition to or expanded time.
It gets a little complicated, and if at the very beginning we would happen to decide that Anders was not an appropriate procedure, then what you have is in the Court of Appeals an Anders brief that what?
I think at that point what you have is I think the court could either take it as a regular petition filed under 3.4, or the court could find that the petition is not adequate. I think last year the Court of Appeals took essentially a letter, a little more than a letter, from counsel and found that it was not adequate and sent it back saying either file an Anders brief or file a true petition. And in that case, counsel chose to file a true petition. And so I think there would be the same case here, you would have to return and say, Anders is no longer your option. You need to file a true petition.
But the child's, or the parent's rights would be protected in any event?
In any event. It would essentially start the whole clock over.
Ms. Casillas, do you have any information from us concerning whether we, what Anders' procedure, if any, is utilized in the criminal arena, and whether anyone actually makes use of that procedure, if it exists?
I'll have to apologize as well. I do not have any information about the criminal procedure. I do have some information. It's addressed somewhat in the Boulder County's brief about it, how much it's utilized in other states in DNN procedures. I know in, let's see, the Boulder County brief states that in South Dakota, they adopted Anders a little more than 5 years ago. They have only had 3 Anders briefs filed in that amount of time. In Utah, since they have adopted Anders, it doesn't mention how many cases they have had filed, but they did say that there's only been one time that they've even sent the Anders case back to have supplemental briefing done. So I think we're talking about a very limited number of cases here. My understanding is there are only about 100 DNN cases, appeals, filed a year in Colorado. So of that number, the number that would be potentially Anders cases are very minimal. I think what they have found in Utah is the same issue that we've spoken about here today, is instead of taking the effort of filing an Anders brief and going down that road, they generally file an appeal that says something to the effect of there's insufficient evidence. But that, I think, is what we're trying to avoid, of having the Court of Appeals have those types of briefs on a regular basis.
Now, I mentioned earlier that, of course, there may be a reason why Court of Appeals would have the opportunity to see that more than we would. However, what we do see are a lot of petitions for cert. Would an Anders procedure, if we adopted one, apply to petitions for cert?
I think it would. I think all the same ethical issues when applying for cert are at bay. Either way, I think ultimately you're asking an attorney to ask for something that they don't think is appropriate after analyzing the facts. So I would assume that it would apply to both. I apologize. I have used up too much time. Do you have anything you want to add? 30 seconds. She'd like 30 seconds, so
okay.
Thank you very much.
You sat in traffic a long time, so I think we'll give you a little more than 30 seconds.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Paula Constantakis-Young. I'm substituting for Robert Trudell, the guardian ad litem in this case. And in listening to this argument, the one point that I would like to make here is that the JL's focus is on what is in the child's best interest. Permanency is in the child's best interest. And in weighing the rights of the parents, you have to look at a three-part test or three-part balancing. First is due process to the parents. Second is permanency. And third is state resources. I think we've talked about due process to the parents. Of course, children have a fundamental interest in having their parents' rights terminated according to law. The parents have a right to an appeal, but in an Anders brief, counsel has looked at the facts. Termination proceedings are not proceedings of short duration. They usually last a year to 2 years. Unlike a mental health case, in which you may have a hearing within 10 days after a person is certified. So there's been a lot of time for the parent to comply. And the court, the counsel is saying, I've gone through everything. I cannot find a reason for appeal. The second point is permanency. Frivolous appeals or appeals that do not have issues of merit will delay permanent placement for a child. That is not in a child's best interest. Thirdly, there are state resources. The cost to the state to fund and process, which is essentially a frivolous appeal, when state resources could be better spent on other matters, such as more resources to fund an expedited transcript so that the attorneys aren't forced to file their opening brief or the petition for appeal without having the benefit of the transcript. This would save the state a lot of money. And this is the point that I would like to make, is that you have to consider the balancing. Just because Andrew's briefs are available does not mean that attorneys are going to use them routinely. And if an attorney files an Andrew's brief, the court may deny it. But that opportunity is there because it is in the best interest of the minor child to receive a permanent placement as soon as possible. And often children...
I'm kind of losing you here, because the thing that says one, the only thing that has seemed real clear to me is that the procedure following Andrews, depending on what we adopt, is going to be difficult to keep within current time frames. So explain to me how it is that that an Andrews brief, forgetting ethical considerations, is in the best interest of a child. It seems to me it can only be if we can manage to somehow keep any procedure following within current time frames. It seems to me the child is, the best interest of the child are disinterested in whether it's Andrews or not and only interested in the time frames.
Because if you don't allow an Andrews brief and you have to proceed with an appeal, then you have to go through the normal appellate process.
Yeah, but you're assuming that the normal appellate process is more time-consuming than the Andrews appellate process, and I'm just not quite understanding that.
Well, you're right, Your Honor. I am assuming that. I'm assuming that an Andrews brief is going to be quicker, and I think it's been quicker in other states that have adopted it. So that's the benefit of it. It weeds out frivolous appeals. That's the point I want to make, is that it provides for more state resources for other matters, and I do think it allows for a quicker disposition of the case. I believe my time is up. If you don't have any other questions, thank you very much.
On behalf of the court, I want to thank all of you for your arguments. The case will stand submitted.